I am always thirsty. And while we all love to keep hydrated, plain water definitely gets boring. And that's why I'm so excited to be working with AirUp for this series of the podcast. AirUp is a revolutionary new taste experience. It's a bottle that flavors ordinary water with scent. And trust me, you have to try it. I was shook. So here comes the science bit. When you taste things, your tongue only does part of the job. It tells you whether things are sweet, sour, umami, salty, or bitter. But most of our taste, aka flavor, is perceived by the olfactory receptors in our nose. AirUp's one-of-a-kind drinking system transports carefully crafted flavors through the back of our mouth to our nose, where taste is perceived. Your brain interprets the scent as flavor, and there you have it. No sugar, no sweeteners, no nothing. Just plain water and the power of scent. So here's how it works. You fill up the bottle with water, still or sparkling, put the straw inside the bottle with the mouthpiece attached, and pop on a scent pod. To activate the scent pod, all you have to do is pull it up gently until it stops. If it's not activated, you will just drink water. Drink normally through the straw, and while you sip, the scent transports the flavor from the back of our mouth to our nose, and you get all that lovely taste. You can check out the full range of bottles, pods, and accessories at air-up.co.uk, and you get 10% off full price items using my code RAIN. Hydration just got more exciting, babes. Hey, I'm Josh Smith, and welcome to RAIN. This podcast is all about empowerment and open conversations with incredible guests. So let's get straight into it. I am fully obsessed with Queen Charlotte on Netflix, and I'm so excited that this week we're joined by one of the show stars, Sam Clement. Queen Charlotte is a Bridgerton prequel series which follows the love story between Queen Charlotte and King George. But it isn't the only love story in the show. Sam's character Brimsley, the Queen's butler and right-hand man, is in a secret relationship with the King's butler, Reynolds. Today, Sam talks about how powerful it was to bring the first queer love story to the Bridgerton verse. We cover the debate around whether straight actors should be playing queer roles, and Sam reflects on his career, which started with him originating the role of Albus Potter in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, both on Broadway and the West End. Not only is this a special chat because it's our first recording in the new RAIN studio, I love Sam's storyline in Queen Charlotte, and as a gay man, in case you haven't noticed, it really hit me. So I hope you love hearing about how Sam brought Brimsley to life too.
Welcome.
I get to christen it, I hear.
We are christening the studio today. And I mean, I'm so excited to have you on because I am high-key obsessed with Queen Charlotte.
You enjoyed?
Did I enjoy? The emotional roller coaster that I went on watching that show.
I told you.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot to take on. But you are playing the young Brimsley, who people will know already from Bridgerton.
Yes.
Walk me through the Brimsley that we meet in this show, though, because he's a bit more, he's got a little bit of a past we might not necessarily expect.
Yes. So we know very little, I suppose, about Brimsley from the Bridgerton era that the brilliant Hugh Sachs plays. And we see the younger Brimsley in this origin story of Queen Charlotte. And he is the butler to the Queen, and she has come over from Germany to marry the King.
Yeah.
Not something she necessarily wants to do and doesn't quite know how to behave within the monarchy. And that's fair enough. When you're getting married off to someone, I'd be pretty pissed off as well. Anyway, so he knows his job inside out. He is ready for anything. He has grown up in the court. His parents have worked in the court. He's been waiting for this moment. Mm-hmm. He finally gets to serve someone very, very high up. And he suddenly has to deal with this tornado that is Queen Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And having to divert around everything he knows to try and serve her and thinking on his feet. So the man is kind of fueled with a lot of anxiety, going, what the hell am I meant to do to try and make this okay for this young queen? And then as the series progress, we see more of how his relationship with the Queen develops and starting to hint towards the relationship that the older Brimsley and the older Queen have. And then learn a bit more about him as a person and this relationship that he has with the Kingsman,
yeah.
Reynolds.
Well, that kicks off.
That kicks off out of nowhere.
Does kick off out of nowhere. Definitely.
Were you expecting it?
Maybe not at that moment. I was like, wow, they're really ruffling the ruffs here, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Hammer and tongue. Well, we are going to get on. There are going to be some plot spoilers in this episode. So
if you've not
yourself.
Seen it, hang on and see it first before listening to this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Otherwise, there will be plot spoilers. But let's take it back to the beginning of this journey for you with Queen Charlotte. Where are you at in your life when this role came along, and what was your audition process like?
So I auditioned for this beginning of 2022, mm-hmm. so last year. And I've kind of had a longer experience auditioning with the Bridgerton world as it is. I first auditioned for a part in the original Bridgerton series in 2019, and that was the first, I believe, of about 3 or 4 auditions that then led to this.
Wow.
Yeah, so I
read... God loves a trier.
God loves a trier. I stand by that. I really stand by that. And they did this like blanket call of actors reading for a part within it. And I believe a lot of people read for the King. But you were reading a scene from Bridgerton. No one really knew what you were auditioning for. You sent the scene in, didn't hear anything. Pretty standard. And then this audition came around for Brimsley, but he was called Bosley, I think, in the audition breakdown because they were keeping names hush-hush, not wanting to give too much away. And I was in New York at the time, and I was getting ready to do the tape, and I'd had a bit of a bad day, so I went out and had a bit to drink and had some Mexican food, and then I came back and I said to my partner, oh, do you know what, let's just do it now, and try not to think too much about it. And then lo and behold, I got the part.
How quickly after you sent the tape in?
Oh, so I sent it in on a Friday, heard on the Monday that there was a recall that same day, met Tom Verica, our brilliant director. And then after that, the tapes go off and do their rounds with all the people that have to see them. And then within 2 days after that, so it would have been the Wednesday, I'd got the offer. So it went from 0 to 100 out of nowhere. And I stand by the fact that don't overthink tapes, don't try and overdo the work, just give an essence of what you can with it, and that will go down a lot better than trying to overwork a scene, which is very easy to do sometimes as an actor. So it came at a point where I hadn't worked for a while because pandemic and all the other stuff, and it was a very welcomed job.
Yeah.
When it came around.
A little bit of Dutch courage always goes a long way, doesn't it?
Goes a long way. Maybe I'll do that from now on. A gin tonic before doing a take.
And the role's really taken on a life of its own, hasn't it?
Yes.
Because when you first... Did you think it was only going to be quite a small role when you first got it?
Yeah. So when we was doing when you get the part and you start doing the deal and working out how involved you are, I believe they sort of said it would be like 3 or 4 scenes per episode, maybe with some dialogue, and then sort of similar to a lot of the stuff in Bridgerton. He's sort of following behind, and it's Yes, Your Majesty, and that's kind of the role. But we got episodes 1 and 2 through, and then I read episode 2 and went, "Whoa, okay, there's a bit more to this than I thought." And then as more and more episodes came through, because you know Shonda brilliantly writes it as we work and mold the characters,
keeping
around
your toes,
us, keeping us on our toes, molding the characters around us as actors, which is lovely, and thrilling working that way. That's how the role came about.
Yeah, and now we've got this amazing relationship on our screens. And from watching this as a queer person, it's so incredible to see Brimsley as a gay character in a relationship with the King George's butler and Reynolds, which is so special. And it is the first main queer storyline in Bridgerton world.
Bridgerton verse, yeah.
So how special has that been to bring that to the screen?
I felt very honoured that Shonda had entrusted me with the role of younger Brimsley. And being able to see this queer relationship blossom within this show, this inclusive world that Shonda has created so brilliantly. And I felt very, very empowered being able to tell this part of the story, as everyone else felt empowered doing their own roles themselves. And I hope that people feel as empowered watching it as we did making it.
Yeah. And whilst the representation is so important, it is so great to see it, there is definitely, and there's no escaping, there's a debate
course.
At the moment, about who should be getting to play certain roles. And I think a lot of people watching this or watching the show will feel that this is a role that should go to a queer actor. Mm-hmm. And I think being a straight man playing this role, it's important that we definitely address that head on. So for anyone who is watching this or has had those concerns after seeing the show, what would you want to say to them about the way that you've approached it?
Yeah, I mean, first off, I love and respect the LGBTQ plus community. And I think it's incredibly important to continue to have this conversation. I think when it comes to authenticity and representation and equal opportunities for everyone in the entertainment industry, it's incredibly important to have these discussions. And that's why I would love to have this discussion today. But as I've said, I feel honored that Shonda has entrusted me with this part. I think it's really important for anyone that doesn't identify as the role they're playing, per se, that it's handled with respect and integrity and sensitivity, because we're dealing with human beings. As actors, our job is to study human behavior. I mean, that's literally what we do on a day-to-day basis. I'm obsessed by people watching and just, oh, what's going on in that life? And what's going on in that life? And just taking tidbits, whether it's how someone talks or how someone holds themselves physically. And so when it came to myself approaching this role, I wanted to focus on what it was that was the prerogative in his life, first off, which is his duty, and it's his duty to serve the Queen, and that's who he is. And the more I dived into this relationship between him and Reynolds, started, because again, we would get the scripts episode by episode and we didn't have everything at the beginning. I was learning as Shonda was writing and she was learning about the character. I was really starting to learn about the isolation that the younger Brimsley goes through within the show. And I think the more I've now watched the show in its entirety, actually everyone is very isolated within these roles back then. So this theme of isolation is so huge within this world. And his relationship with Reynolds is born out of the fact that he doesn't have anyone else. The only downtime he gets, and he doesn't get much downtime at all, is with him. And sometimes it's the power play between the two, and he wants to find out information from Reynolds and vice versa. But what they do have is not just this beautiful physical attraction, but they become each other's emotional support system. And that was absolutely my main focus and my main way into this element of his storyline, was this person seeking solace in someone else that lives a very isolated life. And dealing with the scenes as and when they came and when we were shooting them, it was all about the given circumstances in that moment and focusing on the objective. And then within that, if it's touching on the romantic storyline, it's making sure, and we had a continuous conversation with the director and with Freddie, who plays Reynolds, that we are dealing with it in a very respectful manner. And I hope that people feel like we've achieved that. And that was always my intention.
Yeah. And I think that definitely comes across, because
I hope so.
My personal opinion about it being someone from the queer community is that if it's someone doing it in a sensitive way, I have no problems with a straight guy playing a queer role, because, you know, Cate Blanchett's very amazingly played many queer roles. Yeah. And then you have at the other spectrum of it, say, for instance, James Corden playing a very, very sort of like pastiche version of what camp looks like and should and what he thought camp was like in The Prom, which was borderline offensive. Yep. Whereas this is such a sensitive, and it's so beautifully done that watching it, I don't see how there can be any criticism drawn towards it, because like you're saying, it comes from this place of he's an isolated character and the relationship kind of forms off the back of that.
And I hope, and I and it's so wonderful, I think, as you've already touched on, seeing a queer relationship within this very, very inclusive world that, that Shonda has created and continues to create and continues to expand. And I really hope that everyone watching it feels as empowered as we did.
Yeah. And that's what's so special about it, because it is a relationship which exists so at the same time as the King and Queen's relationship and every other relationship in the show. Yeah. So it's not necessarily seen as or pegged as this is a queer relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of where I feel like we need to get to with representation full stop, is we're just saying this is relationship.
Yeah.
And if you're going to play a character and you're going to do it sensitively, everyone should be able to play who they want to play. And if you've got the talent and the skills to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm of the opinion that whenever we tell stories nowadays and how we receive entertainment, these stories, regardless of the period in which they are set, have to reflect the society in which we live and we want to live. Mm. And I feel like with all of Shonda's work, that's what she's so brilliant at doing. You know, this is loosely based around history, but it's a fictional piece. Mm. And she's intentionally made this story the way she has. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a really wonderful thing.
And we're also getting into a very difficult territory if we start auditioning people only based on their sexuality too, because that's also a very intrusive thing. Say, like, for instance, if you were going to play a role, or if I was a gay actor and I was going to play a role, and they went, well, can we just check that what your sexuality is before that?
It's really insensitive.
Yeah.
It's really, really insensitive. And I firmly disagree with that way of casting. I mean, I don't... It can absolutely be a conversation within the way someone casts a show, but that's not the way to go about this, you know.
And I think especially in this universe, in the British universe, where Shonda Rhimes has really pushed and really changed the way that we cast and look at costume dramas, I feel like it makes this debate kind of null and void in a way, because you do kind of see all these different people getting to play different roles in a way that we never done before. So it's not even just blind casting, it's intentional casting at the same time.
Absolutely intentional casting with every role that she has created. She's gone, nope, this is how we cast that role. And it doesn't need to fit some sort of historical fact. It's loosely based on that. And we will tell the story that we want to tell to reflect these characters' lives in the most beautiful and truthful way possible. Mm.
And I think what's so interesting about it is to see a queer relationship existing in the 19th century is so amazing, because I feel like when I watch queer love stories on TV, they mostly exist from like the mid 20th century onwards.
Yeah.
And they always exist in a prism of, for instance, being told through moments of crisis or really negative tones through like the HIV crisis, which obviously needs to be shown on screen.
Absolutely.
But it's also so refreshing to see a relationship that predates A, that period, and B, is a very positive one as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it kind of reminds everyone who's watching this that queer people have been here since day dot.
Human beings are human beings, and love is love, and love has existed in all of its possibilities, for the want of a better phrase, since day dot. I firmly believe that. So we should be reflecting these storylines in a period piece, because of course a queer relationship would have existed back then, and it very much exists now. So let's see it. Let's see it and love it and feel it and hear it in a period drama. It's so important.
And there is one bit which I need to talk about off the back of what you just said, because I know I also might quite actually think about this because it very emotionally affects me watching it.
Yeah.
And this is a spoiler. But in the last episode where the King and Queen throw the ball and everyone's dancing, everyone's having a jovial time, rocking their corsets with the wigs, everything. Yeah.
Marvellous.
Brimsley and Reynolds are off dancing in the shadows.
Yeah, they sneak
on their own.
Have a moment,
And then it then cuts to Brimsley, older Brimsley, dancing on his own. I'm literally holding back the tears thinking about this. That moment is so special, because they're still in this society today. So many relationships and so much love that is still existing in the shadows. And queer people have existed in the shadows for so long in terms of history, because history's told through a patriarchal viewpoint. And so to see that shown on screen and dealt with in such a sensitive way is so powerful. What was that like to shoot that scene?
I mean, I remember reading it for the first time and being blown away about how beautiful it was. I mean, it's such a small moment, but it is so beautiful, and it really does like speak a thousand words. But actually shooting it was kind of chaos, and that's nothing to do with the storyline. It's the fact we were doing it at 3:40 in the morning. We'd done a long night shoot, and we were meant to have a good hour to shoot this moment. And we got round to it, and we're like, right, we haven't got much time. So we channeled our energy, but we know what we're doing. We know the story we're telling. Try and remember the dance moves. And went with it. And I actually think it added to the performance, because it is two people sneaking off and having, as they always have, no more than 20 minutes. And sometimes that's a push.
Yeah.
And just
they get a lot done in that 20 minutes.
Get a lot done in the 20 minutes. Don't hang about. But it's them just taking a moment and being able to look in each other's eyes and be present with each other while everyone else is having their jolly old time of it. And I think that energy really added to that moment and what it's become. Even though it was chaos on set when we were doing it, it just felt right, I suppose. And you know, there was people crying off the camera. It was a really sweet moment. And then me and Freddie went to watch Hugh do his moment on his own, and that was then about 3:50 in the morning, and full on blubbed because it was so beautiful. And he's so wonderful to work with, and so easy to work with and learn from. I'm very, very lucky to have him to look up to, and I really realised it in that moment. We then went back to the hotel afterwards, and we were sat outside this hotel in Oxford for 2 hours just chatting, and went, 7:00, we have to go to bed. But we were so emotionally stimulated from what we just shot. We couldn't let any of it go. We just had to talk about it more and more and more. So that's a very long-winded answer of going, it was amazing and chaotic and just sort of perfect.
Yeah, and it is perfect.
I'm glad you think so.
Like, honestly, it's such an impressive and incredible moment. And there's no escaping that Bridgerton is very well known for the sex scenes.
Yes.
And
yes,
you indeed. Definitely do have a few sex scenes of your own.
We do, yep.
In this.
We do.
How did you prepare for tackling that aspect of Brimsley's and Reynolds' relationship?
So we have a brilliant intimacy coordinator and her team in Lizzie Talbot and Lucy Fennell. And Lucy was on set with us every time there was some sort of intimate scene. And it's a closed set, so there's less people on set. And having the intimacy coordinator there to iron out the way the scene's going to be run makes it a very respectful and calm set, and we're then able to do our jobs. And there's like there's contractual things in terms of like an intimacy rider, where you go, this is what I'm happy with, this is me setting out what I'm comfortable to do and comfortable to show. And Freddie does the same thing, and you know, India and Corey will also do the same thing. So we already know the boundaries on the day. And the director very brilliantly, and Lucy as well, goes, and if anything needs to change on the day, you're not comfortable about something, that's fine. And if you want to watch a shot back to make sure you're happy with this moment, that's fine. So it's a really, really fluid situation. And because they then create such a respectful environment, you can focus on the work you're meant to be doing in the scene. If we're talking about then the first scene that we have, it's a power play. It's me trying to get information from Reynolds, and Reynolds not willing to disclose it. And then you add all the layers onto that, and it becomes really heated and really sexy. But to be able to create that, you have to have that very open and respectful environment. And that's absolutely how they go about shooting everything in the Bridgerton world.
And it's the opposite of sexy in real life.
I mean, it was absolutely the opposite of sexy in real life. I mean, like you might before a take go, can I have a mint? Can I have a quick mint? Because I don't feel good about this. I feel like a coffee breath. So it's little things like that. Because me and Freddie are such close friends. We became such close friends so quickly. You just have a laugh with it, because you go, this is all a bit silly, all a bit ludicrous. Yeah. And that energy, that sort of bubbly energy, again, just adds to it. And like the physicality of how them scenes work as well.
And those scenes aren't there just for the sake of it. And I think that's what makes Bridgerton so great, in that the sex scenes are there for a narrative purpose.
Yeah.
And they are 100%, as you've been saying, there for a narrative purpose in terms of Brimsley and Reynolds.
Yep.
But as a human, you as a human being who's shredding that character, you still have to get naked on the screen, and you have to do these sex scenes. And I guess it's a very vulnerable place to have to go to.
Yeah.
But there is so much power in leaning into our vulnerability.
Absolutely.
Isn't there? Did it kind of empower your relationship with your body image in a new way, do you think?
Oh, totally. I mean, I was really nervous before doing it, because it's the first intimate scene I've ever done on stage, on screen. So I didn't know how the day was going to play out, even though we've been told everything beforehand. This is how it's going to work, and this is all you have to do. You don't have to do any more than you've said. I defy anyone not to still be nervous. And again, it's like, oh, worried about how I'm going to look and how I'm going to feel in the moment and how I'm going to feel watching it back. But as soon as you just start playing the scene and focusing on the acting and your objective as for your character in that moment, all of that sort of vulnerability goes, or you sort of forget about it. And it's that in itself empowers you to be, or empowered me anyway, to feel like actually I'm more comfortable in my body and my own skin than I thought I was. So yeah, as nerve wracking as them scenes are, I think I did take away a lot of confidence in myself and how I feel in myself.
What a gift to be given.
Such
that.
A gift, yeah, yeah. And this, and again, because the scenes are so brilliantly written by Shonda. I mean, that scene is fantastic. I remember reading it through in the read through for everyone, and people coming up after us going, such a good scene. So many layers to it. So I was like, yeah, it really is. And when you can, when you've got all that in amongst the intimacy stuff, it makes your job easier and a lot more fun, and empowers you to feel good about yourself.
And the element of the story, which is very powerful and goes throughout the whole series across all the different characters, is this idea of touch.
Yes.
And I really noticed this, especially in the scene where Brimsley is like kind of trying to like nudge up to Reynolds. And then like
the unspoken scene.
The unspoken scene. And when Brimsley wants to go and comfort Queen Charlotte, just holds his hand.
Yeah.
But still keeps very far back. But she knows that touch is there and that comfort.
Oh, I'm
is there.
So glad you love that scene. I'm so glad you love that scene.
I was like, oh my God, here we go again.
Yeah, it was a very that particular one with the Queen was a really intense day, because there's so much going on with India, or you know, with Queen Charlotte for India at that point, and subsequently for Brimsley as well. And I think that particular moment and that gesture and everything that's going on internally is absolutely the foundation of their relationship and what they mean to each other. And she's so aware that he is there for her in that moment, and that is them forevermore. And it's so lovely to hear that you got such a touching sense out of that scene.
Yeah.
And then the scene with Freddie, this idea of touch. We had an historian come in and, you know, just talk us through the day-to-day life back in the Georgian period. And she did talk to us about this idea of touch and what it meant to have moments being able to have human contact and skin to skin contact. That meant even more to someone because everyone is covered up in these beautiful, beautiful costumes. To have these intimate moments with people, which didn't really happen unless they were behind closed doors, mean the world to them. And you know, their relationship is quite hostile at that point. We've had a lot of bickering. He's not telling me stuff with what's going on with the king. And I'm trying to tell the queen to sort her, or to, you know, make her understand what's going on that side of the palace.
They've had a right domestic, basically.
And they've had a right domestic. And Brimsley's trying to sort it out, and you're not helping, and I can't help you, and I'm frustrated. And they come together when the king and the queen get together, and he nudges up to him and just touches him and tries to sort of reconcile in that moment without saying anything, because they are still on duty. There are still footmen down the corridor, and the king and queen are right behind them in the bedroom. So it's another little touching moment without anything spoken. That's a really lovely point about the series. I remember Tom saying to us when he was in the edit, he said, some of my favorite moments are all of the unspoken segments. And there's so much of that that's just scored, and there's no dialogue that we hear. And it's being able to see the story told through the physicality and the physicality of touch and what that means to people back then. I think they are some of the most special moments in the show.
You deliver the lines really well, but those moments blurred a bit. I was like,
just stop talking. Just stop talking. Everyone shut up.
But one of the things I really took away from Queen Charlotte as well is that in this show, the agency is totally with women of colour and queer characters.
Yep.
And it's so rare to see a show, mm-hmm. especially in a period drama context, where those characters are given the agency in a very patriarchal mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. How empowering was it to be part of that and to help tell that story?
Oh, incredibly empowering. I mean, just reading the scripts, all of us felt such a huge sense of pride in the read-throughs and hearing it out loud for the first time. It's what we've talked about already. It's the intentional casting from Shonda. It's a reflection of what we want our society to be, which is very inclusive and very, very fluid, making it as equal as it should be for everybody.
Time for a little break, and I don't know about you, but I am thirsty, and I'm so thrilled to be working with AirUp for this series of Rain. Hydration is so key to our all-round well-being, but plain old water can get very boring. AirUp is a completely new taste experience that flavors water through scent. It works like it's magic, but it's just incredible science. And because of this, AirUp works without any sugar or sweeteners. You just add a scented pod to the top of your AirUp water bottle, and it tricks your mind into thinking the water is flavored when you drink. Trust me when I tell you, you have to try it. So don't forget my discount code. You get 10% off full price items when you head to air-up.co.uk and use the code RAIN.
Even if you're not part of different communities that are represented mm-hmm. in this show, mm-hmm. there are so many universal human themes in it, like
isolation.
And everyone can relate to that feeling of feeling isolated at some points in their lives.
I mean, I think particularly as well after living through a pandemic as well. I mean, that's such a... everyone has lived through this idea of isolation. Mm. Everybody.
And the themes of mental health are very powerful. Yeah. In it too, off the back of that kind of idea of them being isolated as well. Mm-hmm. How have you learned to look after your own mental health?
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic was a real big one for me, and I saw some therapy for the first time, and it was really important for me to understand how I tick as Sam and as us as artists. We are so driven, and all we want to do is work and tell stories. But you know, there's a lot of variables that come with booking jobs, and coming back from the pandemic, there were lots of opportunities, but there was a lot of people that weren't working. Everybody wasn't working, so booking a job was 10 times harder. And when you spend quite a long period out of work, it's very hard on a day-to-day basis when you take so much self-worth from your work. And so one of the things that I did therapy for was for my day-to-day mental health and not having to rely so much on that self-worth from my job. And how can I make myself happy outside of that? And a huge aspect of that was actually taking onus of my own life in the sense of saying no. I'm such a yes person.
And something that's very relatable to, I think, every single person who's watching is we all deal with rejection.
Oh,
and
God,
we all deal with failure all the time. How have you learned to deal with failure and rejection? Because that is a difficult thing to be able to overcome.
It's part and parcel of this job, and not just for actors, the entertainment industry in general. I mean, in whatever realm you work, you will have to deal with rejection. There's lots of ways I've come to use when it comes to dealing with rejection for scripts themselves or for self-tapes. And now, because everything is on a self-tape, there's very little going in the room unless, you know, you're going to then meet a director after sending in an initial self-tape. What I do is I get the script, I tear it up, and I put it in the bin. And I go, okay, I've done my work on that. I've sent the tape off, and I've put it to one side. Because I used to keep the scripts there. I go, in case there's a recall or they want me to meet the director, I'll just keep it there. And then it sort of looms over your head. And something I started to realize was I can't keep looking at this because all I do is text my agent, go, any news? And then I'm like...
And they're oh my God, you messaged 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. I just messaged me.
I
forgot to tell you got the job. Yeah. I mean, it's so ludicrous that we do that. So I've started to go, I will put the script straight in the bin. And if it comes back, I'll either reprint it or it's already in my head and I've then got it to hand. That's a huge way I deal with the rejection of like not getting jobs. But I also think failure in general as an idea and as a theme, not just within our industry, across the board, that is the world of working and surviving and living, failure is such a huge part of who we are as human beings, and it's character building, and that leads to success. And I think if you want longevity success, then you have to accept that failure is a part of that. And that's a very liberating way I found of thinking about it. Doesn't mean I don't find it hard. Absolutely find it hard. You know, you do 3 or 4 auditions or something and someone goes, it's just not gone your way. That's still really hard to take. And another important thing on that, I think you have to allow yourself to just sit in it for a bit. Allow yourself to be really irritated. You know, allow yourself to go wild for a night and do something you weren't planning on doing just because you feel a bit crap. Allow yourself to feel it, and then you can move on. Because if you try to not to do that and suppress it, you're going to find it harder and harder and harder to come back from and deal with further rejection, because that's never going to stop. It's never going to stop for me. It's never going to stop for you. It's never going to stop for anybody. It's part and parcel of life.
I have like a visual bin in my mind, and producer Amy will know this. When things don't go my way, I'm literally like, she, that, whatever it is in the bin.
Very good. Love that.
And it actually it's actually a great little, I'm going to take the script analogy, popping that in the bin. I'm going to use that for everyday life.
Yeah. There you go.
It's a great one.
Absolutely.
It's a metaphor.
Hold on to that.
Well, we already do it. So there you go. I think it's so interesting what you're saying about failure and rejection and dealing with no's, because again, so many people's self-esteem and the way they value themselves is so based in what they do for a job.
Totally.
And learning to separate your self-esteem from that is such an important thing to do. And I mean, for you, you had such a huge moment in your career where you played Albus Potter in the mega blockbuster theatre production. I mean, the queues, the like people waiting 2 years to get those tickets Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. You did that on the West End. You originated the role there and you went to Broadway. And that was like 3 whole years of your life.
Yeah, it was.
Must have been so intense.
Yeah, it was intense. Still the most extraordinary 3 years of my life to date. The show itself was such a beast. I mean, it was 2 parts. The whole thing lasted, you know, 5.5 hours, and it was a whole day of theatre if you're doing 2 parts in 1 day. So, you know, we come in at 12 o'clock and we don't leave the theatre till 10, half past 10. No, actually sometimes 11, because the show doesn't finish till 10:30. So it was an all-consuming experience. And I also think coming off the back of something like that, all of us, I think, had such an expectation of, things are going to be so much easier now. You know, we've been in this humongous world that is Harry Potter, is the West End, is Broadway, here come the jobs. And it doesn't work like that. And very, very naive of us. And that was a huge learning experience for me after dealing with what was such a monumental production that, lucky enough, won loads and loads of awards. And we had the most amazing time in London and New York. But it's then straight back into the grind of finding the next story that you're going to tell. But dealing with the day to day of a show like that for 3 years, it's a huge discipline that you have to learn, I suppose. And that's a physical one and an emotional one. It's a very physical show. So Stephen Hoggart, our movement director, created this amazing workout for us that we had to do every week. And, you know, we'd start with yoga on a Wednesday and circus on a Thursday, and it would carry on as the week goes on. And that's to make sure we're in the best shape of our life. And then your time off stage, it's making sure you eat pretty well. I mean, have a burger, obviously. You know, have a nice
diet. You've got to have a burger at least once a week.
You've got to have a burger at least once. I totally agree, and I stand by this.
Yeah, I do.
Anyway, eat well doing a show like Harry Potter. The intensity of having to prepare for that show week in, week out was a lot, and we had to follow the discipline that was the fitness regime and looking after ourselves outside the theatre, because it's a monumental story we're telling. Yeah. You know, you have to rack your socks off. Physically, it's very, very demanding. Emotionally, it's very, very demanding. And not just the stuff on stage. I mean, it is literally as much of a ballet off as it is on. And, you know, Stephen started choreographing bits of movement backstage for the crew because it's like, it's so chaotic back there. We have to make sure that this is as fluid as possible because I'm running off one side and running around the back of this humongous stage to come back on in pajamas after being in school uniform. And you've got 10 seconds to do it. So you need free rein to run around, but then this staircase has got to come through. I mean, it's chaos.
Yeah.
But the formula was created and it works brilliantly. Mm.
And when that chaos then stops,
uh-huh.
and then you have to deal with like what comes next, you have to be very prepared for that.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I mean, I found that really hard coming off the back of the show. Really, really hard. Because I defy anyone going from a day to day of doing a monumental piece of theatre to then sort of having no structure to your days. Because theatre requires such structure and routine. And then when you don't, and I'm someone that quite likes routine, when you suddenly don't have that, you do feel like a drowning a little bit. And it took me a while to try and find some equilibrium again. But that all goes back to, you know, the conversation of mental health and how I learn more about myself. And it's a constant conversation and trying to understand what I need to make sure I'm as happy as I can be in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think having great people around you definitely helps.
Yes.
And you had amazing people that you worked with
yeah.
on that show, and you had amazing people that you worked with on Queen Charlotte yeah. as well.
I've been very lucky with the cast and the company of people that I've been able to yeah. work with in my career. Very, very lucky.
But the key co-star we just need to touch on before we finish mm-hmm. is Pom.
Is Pom. Pom Pom. So we had
How did dog handling go for you?
Well, I didn't have to do much. Like, the dog was extraordinary. I think she was, I might get this wrong, but she was a puppy. I think she was like 15 weeks old when we started.
Oh my gosh, she's a child star.
Oh, she's a child star. I mean, anytime she was on screen, I'm lost. I mean, I haven't got a chance. I went, oh, the dog's back. Oh, the whole dog. She's going to steal the show. Yeah, so she was very, very young. And the most well-trained little pup I've ever come across, she was called Victoria. And we had a real bond and she behaved very, very well on set.
Mm.
And I can't praise her enough. And she is the star of the show.
She is the star.
Of course, obviously.
It took us the whole podcast episode to get to the real star of the show.
To get the real star of the show.
Pom.
To Pom.
Yeah. To Pom.
And she's... There's in the older Queen's story, there's so many more Pomeranians running around.
Oh, I know.
Around.
They've like multiplied. She's been busy, Pom.
Oh, so busy. But she was the most well-behaved dog out of all of them.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Extraordinary pup. Tom, the director, was showing us like audition tapes and pictures of the dogs. It's hilarious.
Dogs actually audition?
Yeah, the little videos of them just sort of sitting there going about there.
And they're
basically like, what's the cutest? What's the cutest? Is it well-behaved?
They're not like, give me drama, give me sadness.
I mean, maybe in some productions. We haven't got time for that on Queen Charlotte. We haven't got time for that.
There's enough emotions going on.
Oh,
we can't deal with yours.
We're enough as it is.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a nightmare.
Yeah.
We don't need a nightmare dog.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having
today.
Me
today. And we always end on one final question.
Oh, yes.
And that question always is... In the reign of your life, what is one rule you always live by?
Oh God, there's so many. I think always be yourself. For me, integrity is such an important part of who I am. And the people that I love more than anything in this world have such integrity. And I really admire that in someone. And I stand by that in my own life. And I think that comes back to being able to say and having the onus to say no and going, this is who I am and this is what I need. Mm. And it's an ever developing thing that I'm learning about myself. But that's what I stand by, always trying to be oneself.
Yeah.
Because that's a really important quality.
Integrity is such an important quality. And I think to circle back to what we're talking about at the beginning, a debate about casting.
Yes.
I think you have such amazing integrity and you've done this sensitively.
Thank you very much.
And it's a joy to watch you on screen play Jon Brimsley.
Thank you.
And I just can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much. This has been a joy. Thank
Thanks
you.
So much for joining me to Chris in the studio.
To Chris in the studio.
Thanks for being here for this episode of Reign. If there are things that resonate with you, I'd love to hear from you. Get me on socials at Josh Smith Host. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, rate, subscribe, or follow, and share this with someone you think should hear it. Let's get those convos going, because that is what this podcast is all about. Hi, babes. Me again. Just wanted to tell you about something very exciting. I can't believe I'm about to tell you this, but I've written a book and it's called Great Chat. As you know, I love to chat, plot spoiler, and I love talking to people about their lives because, as I always say, talking and listening is so powerful. The book is all about how you can master conversation and transform your life, just like it has for me. I've used my experience from all the amazing interviews I've been lucky enough to do, as well as a load of research to help you deal with everything from making new friends to embracing difficult discussions. Great Chat should never be underestimated. It can truly improve your well-being, allow you to create the life you want, and bring the connections you are so deserving of, babes. You can pre-order Great Chat today in hardback, ebook, and audiobook, read by me, no less, and it's out on the 20th of June.